Modern technology keeps changing our lives in huge ways. But as writer and producer Rose Eveleth points out, a world with more and more cutting-edge technology can still leave people behind.
The biggest question people can ask themselves is who wins and who loses, right? In these futures that different people are proposing, who are the people who get the most and who are the people who lose the most? And what are the unintended consequences?
We speak with Rose about science, technology, and about her podcast, Flash Forward. Also, we revisit our conversation with Chicago native Jason Diamond. He grew up idolizing John Hughes, the director of many iconic movies about teens from the 80s and 90s, including 16 Candles, The Breakfast Club, Home Alone, and many more. He joins us to discuss his new memoir about how everything he thought he needed to know about life he learned from watching 80s movies. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Your troubles. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo today. Sometimes it feels like we live in the future, or at least that we're surrounded by technology, whether it's instant access to the news, a phone that knows your face, or Elon Musk saying he can build a train that goes from San Francisco to L.A. in half an hour. The world has already changed so much. Scientists, business and tech executives, and others love to talk about how technology can spark even bigger changes in our everyday lives. But is there something missing in the way we talk about the future? And how do we make sure the future doesn't leave people behind? Rose Eveleth is a producer and writer who explores how humans grapple with science and technology. She's also the producer and host of Flash Forward, a podcast about the future. I spoke with Rose last week when she was in town to speak at the University of Illinois. Rose, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
We're talking right now before you're giving a talk at the Beckman Institute at the University of Illinois, and your talk is titled The Future is for Everyone. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that, as you sort of mentioned in the intro here, there are a lot of people who are out there imagining the future. Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, and they have a certain kind of way of thinking about the future. They have certain kinds of problems that they are interested in. And I think it's fair to say that they don't necessarily represent everyone. The people who have the money and the platform often don't necessarily look like a lot of people who are going to live in that future. So the question is, how do we bring more people into that fold, and how do we make sure that when we are imagining the future, we're not imagining a future that leaves a lot of the population behind?
Yeah, you kind of touched on this, I think. But when you talk about or write about the way that we imagine the future and how we need to be more inclusive, are you mainly talking about that tech world?
Yes and no. I think, you know, I come from a science background, and so it's easier for me to talk about that. And it's also sort of a good way to break down the idea that science and technology are neutral and are sort of value neutral and are egalitarian. I think a lot of people think that. It's pretty easy to explain why that's not the case if you just look at some examples. It's easier to explain why politics, for example, or the future of governance is a political thing. But, you know, on Flash Forward, we do talk about other things that are not just science and technology. So a recent episode we did was about what would really happen if California seceded from the U.S., mm-hmm. Which was a proposal that was floating around for a while. And one of the questions I tackled on the show was, okay, what happens to Native American reservations in California? This is a question that I had never seen answered anywhere mm-hmm. in these conversations. And that's a group of people that is largely left out of the conversation. And do they stay in the U.S. or with the U.S.? Do they have this agreement? Do they go with California? Like, what does that look like? Right. If they stay as sort of in this agreement with the U.S., are they then these weird islands inside of California? So those are also parts of the questions that we ask. But technology and science is what I tend to focus on when I give talks like this, because it is this area that people seem to think is apolitical, which I think is sort of not quite in line with reality.
Sure. And why do you think futurism, if we're going to call it that, is such a male-dominated area?
It's hard to say. There are a lot of people who have a lot of ideas about this. Futurism is an odd field because it's not really one thing. It's not like, you know, genetics, where you sort of go down a path and you become a geneticist. People come to futurism from so many different places. And there's actually a big sort of debate about what futurism even is, who is a futurist, who's allowed to call themselves a futurist. You know, Elon Musk is a futurist, but doesn't have training in strategic foresight, which is sort of the fancy term for futurism. And so there is sort of a big question about it. But I mean, a lot of it centers around math and technology. A lot of it centers around engineering, economics, sort of fields that have largely been dominated by a certain kind of person. And also, you know, when we talk about popular futurism, people who are given that stage, that already tends to be a certain kind of person. You know, like women of color are rarely elevated to expert level at these kinds of topics, which I think is a problem and part of what we're trying to address in Flash Forward and the talk.
You know, one example you've written about technology that isn't necessarily inclusive is this idea of robot assistants. What does the invention of these robot assistants tell us about the present?
Well, it's less about the invention of them and more about the way they're coded and framed, right? Your robot assistant is almost always a woman. They either have a female name or they have a woman's voice. You can then go in and change it, right? You know, you can get Siri to sound like a British guy if you would like a British male assistant. But the default in the assumed sort of version when you get it out of the box is almost always a woman. And that sort of says something about the way we see assistants, the way we see subservience, the way that we see people who are helping us and sort of not considered bosses, not considered, you know, people who we are going to listen to. Really, they're people who are helping us. And that's sort of a coded choice, right? You can make your bot literally anything. It could be a robot from Mars. It could be, and doesn't have to have a gender. Why does an assistant have to even have a gender? But these companies are making choices because they seem to think that people are more comfortable taking orders from or sort of getting help from a sort of subservient sounding woman sounding voice.
Yeah, another popular futuristic idea is what's called the life extension movement. So people like Peter Thiel and Aubrey de Grey want to spend millions of dollars to figure out how they can live forever. Any problems with that?
Well, putting aside the science problems with that, I mean, there's a really funny thing that a futurist named Madeline Ashby says, and she says, living forever is great if you're making compound interest, right? Because you have to have a certain amount of quality of life and sort of you sort of solved all the problems in your current life. And so you're like, oh, this is really great. I'm doing great. And I would like to do great for forever. There are a lot of people in the world who that's not their main question. They're not asking how they can prolong the current status they have. They're asking how they can improve their lives, not extend the lives they have. So the majority of the people who you see looking at and sort of promoting life extension in sort of the most ambitious form of this whole idea of living forever, you know, Aubrey de Grey kind of stuff, tend to be people who are pretty comfortable in life. And that's fine for them. If they would like to live forever, that's great. But there are a lot of people out there who would really like, you know, things like affordable health care, you know, and other parts of their lives to be much better as opposed to prolonging the sort of current status that they're in.
Sure. You know, I'd like to play a couple of clips from your podcast, Flash Forward. One of the things you do in each episode is to create some audio from the future to play for listeners. So here, this is from a world where today's teenagers start running for office in the future, and all of their social media content is just out there. Let's take a listen to this political ad from the future.
When Kid Lou Fair was 14, they founded the Trans Student Activist Resource Center at her high school. What was Kara Sackhoff doing? Running a Kim Kardashian fan Tumblr. When Kid Lou Fair was 15, they marched against the discriminatory bathroom bills in North Carolina and Mississippi. What was Kara Sackhoff doing? Tweeting conspiracy theories about Taylor Swift. Our nation deserves someone with a true record of change, not just a popular Snapchat account. The choice is clear. Vote Lou Fair.
That a clip from the podcast Flash Forward, and in that episode, we're imagining a future where today's kids are now running for office. Everything they've ever posted is ripe for political attacks. That episode from July of last year. And Rose, I have to ask, especially with some of the episodes you've done about politics, does it feel like we're already living in that world we just heard there?
It's sort of funny. You know, some episodes have aged better than others. You know, there are some that come around. You know, I did one of the first episode ever of the show was about artificial wombs. And there's, you know, new research on that. And so I do like updating the shows and updating, doing little like, hey, remember this? You know, we talked about it. Here's the new research. This one was last year. It was sort of before the election cycle really got going. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, I feel like I got this one really wrong because it seems like no one cares what people say. Social media histories are, which maybe is a good thing, you know. And in the episode, we actually explore this idea of like, do we really want to be holding people to their opinions they had when they were 15, right? Mm-hmm. I had terrible opinions when I was 15. I think we probably all did. Is that really sort of the bar? And can you escape sort of maybe something that you did or said when you were a kid and then also balance that with accountability and making sure that we're not just letting everybody off the hook for things that are like truly vile? And now we're sort of living in this world where it seems like social media is a free-for-all and whatever anybody says doesn't really matter, which is really interesting and sort of not probably not what I would have predicted, because the whole episode is sort of premised on this idea that these things might come back to bite people. And that sort of seems to not be the case, at least for certain politicians that we see in office today.
Sure. Let's play another clip here from Flash Forward. This is from a world where people regularly get to visit Mars as tourists. And we're hearing two people talk about what some of the things you could do for fun might be on Mars.
So have you ever gone low gravity snowboarding? Okay, so it's a very different experience. The thing is you're not going to be snowboarding on regular ice. You might want to snowboard on nitrogen ice, on Pluto, for example. And it's 1/10 Earth's gravity. So it takes a little while to get up speed. But the nice thing is there's very little atmosphere, so you can really get up the speed as long as you're willing to, like, wait that out and keep going down the mountains.
Yeah, fun stuff. Again, a clip from Flash Forward. What would it be like to visit Mars as a tourist, do you think?
You know, I think it wouldn't be as fun as a lot of people think. I mean, A, it's like relatively dangerous still to go to Mars. And let's say that we've solved all of those problems. It's really, really dusty. And the dust is actually a huge problem for spacecraft, right? Because as soon as you get dust in seals and other things, you have huge problems. Mm-hmm. It takes a really long time to get there. And that's actually a problem that we're not going to solve unless there's a huge change in what we understand about physics or sort of some huge breakthrough. So you're on a spaceship for a very long time. You get there. And then in order to time your trip back, you have to stay there for a long time, unless you want the trip back to be like double the amount of time, just sort of the way that the planets align. And so you end up on Mars for a 2-year vacation. So all told, you're about 5 years of your life is spent on this Mars vacation, which, like, I mean, I guess I would like to take 5 years off from work, but it sort of seems untenable.
Yeah.
I don't know if my boss is going to be like, yeah, cool, no problem, we'll see you in 5 years. But so getting to Mars is hard. Landing on Mars is hard. Being on Mars could be really fun, but it would require us to solve a whole lot of problems then. And also, you know, I think my favorite part or my favorite idea of going to Mars is actually going and seeing the remains of all the rovers that we have there. Because by the time we get there, they probably won't be in commission anymore. It'll be like this interesting little graveyard of bots that we've sent. And that is sort of the, like, going around and trying to find those would be really cool. It's very beautiful. Mars is very beautiful. If you're willing to, it better be, because you're going to be there for a long time.
Well, and you get to experience low gravity snowboarding.
That's
as
true.
Well.
Yeah. And you can climb up a huge mountain. I mean, there's lots of stuff to do there. You're just probably wearing a very heavy spacesuit.
Right. I'm going to date myself a little bit here. My main experience of thinking about a trip to Mars comes from the 1990 movie Total Recall.
Yeah.
With getting out, if you get out of the, you know, of the domes, you basically die within a couple of minutes. You know,
yeah, and that's probably fair. I mean, they would probably build things underground. It's sort of more economical to, like, have the Earth do the shielding for you. But so you'd be living underground for a lot of your time there, which is, you know, if you go all the way to Mars and you're just, like, underground, I don't know.
What's the most out there future idea that you've looked at on Flash Forward, and what did you learn by covering it on the podcast?
So the most recent episode might be, we've done a couple. There's one that's, you know, what would it be like if space pirates dragged a second moon to Earth and then the Earth had two moons? We've done one where what would happen if the Earth, for some reason, stopped rotating around the sun and just sort of fell into the sun? The most recent episode was about what would it take to completely sterilize the Earth and just kill all life. And that was really fun because, you know, it came out of a paper that some physicists wrote. And what they were trying to really understand is what the likelihood of discovering life on other planets would be. And there are sort of two elements to that, right? The first one is the likelihood that life arises. And that's a really hard question because we only really know about Earth. And we also don't really exactly know how life happened on Earth. And we don't have any other planets to compare it to. The second part of finding life on Earth is how likely is it that you could find a planet that once had life but no longer does have life? So how hard would it be to actually get rid of life once it arises? And that was the question they were asking. And it turns out it's extraordinarily difficult. It would take a huge amount of radiation, enough radiation to actually boil the oceans, to actually kill everything. And they looked at tardigrades, which are these lovely little species that are very, very hard to kill. And it was a really fun episode because it kind of looked at just how hardy life actually is. Someone said it was the most uplifting sort of apocalyptic episode they'd ever heard because it was actually very hopeful because, you know, it would take just so much to kill everything. I mean, humans are one thing, and we do talk a little bit about what it would take for humans to survive some of these things. But the idea that life on Earth is actually really, really robust and very, very difficult to get rid of was really interesting. And the physicists were super surprised, and the biologists I talked to were like, yeah, we know. Which I thought was very funny.
Unless somebody builds a Death Star, of course.
Exactly. Well, you know, that's a whole other episode.
Of course. You know, for people who don't think about futurism or science and technology as part of their everyday lives, what would you like them to know about imagining the future?
I think that everyone is sort of on some level a futurist, right? We're all always thinking about what's next, what we want. And what I would like for people to do is when they see headlines, and part of what I'm hoping to do with Flash Forward is, you know, you see these headlines in the news and you're like, I don't know what any of this means. You know, you have Elon Musk and Peter Thiel and all these people fighting about whether AI is really going to destroy us. And I mean, I cover this for a living and I read those headlines and I'm like, I don't know what you guys are talking about. You know, it's so hard to keep up with it and figure out what's real and what isn't and what you should actually worry about. And so what I've tried to do with Flash Forward is sort of give people a couple of questions that they can ask about these kinds of headlines and sort of ways of thinking about the future. And I think, you know, the biggest question people can ask themselves is who wins and who loses, right? In these futures that different people are proposing, who are the people who get the most and who are the people who lose the most? And what are the unintended consequences? And unintended consequences can be good and they can be bad. And they're all around us, and you don't always know. Obviously, you can't predict everything. You don't always know what's going to happen. But just sort of thinking through some of those very basic questions can really help when you read headlines and think about this stuff, because so much of both futurism and media coverage of futurism is relatively uncritical and also very sensational to be like, oh my God, robots are going to kill us all. And you can kind of just like step back and say like, well, hold on. How close are we really? Should I actually worry about this? Probably not. You know, I think just sort of being a little bit more realistic and also sort of pushing to think about questions that are a little bit more relevant to the average person, which is, you know, not the tunnel underneath the cities to make the train, but maybe like universal healthcare or like universal basic income, or like what are those kinds of things? What does that mean for people?
Rose Eveleth, producer and writer who explores how humans grapple with science and technology, the producer and host of Flash Forward, a podcast about the future. Rose, thank you so much for joining us on the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we go to the 21st Show Archives for an encore of Nyla Boodoo's conversation with Chicago native Jason Diamond about his memoir, Searching for John Hughes. Stay tuned. The 21st continues after this short break.
Listening to the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you're a child of the 80s or just a fan of that time period, chances are you get major nostalgia when you hear that song by Simple Minds, made popular with the 1985 movie The Breakfast Club. Maybe it takes you back to your teenage years when you fell in love with these movies by director John Hughes that finally took teens seriously. You're certainly not alone. And in fact, these movies had such an impact on one Chicago native, Jason Diamond, that in his 20s, he made it his goal to write the untold story of John Hughes. The book that resulted is quite a bit different than the one he initially set out to write. It is about John Hughes, but more so it's about Jason's personal journey growing up in the Chicago suburbs, idolizing the famous movie director. Jason Diamond is the author of the new memoir, Searching for John Hughes, or Everything I Thought I Needed to Know About Life I Learned from Watching 80s Movies. He joins us on the line now from New York City, where he now lives. Hey, Jason, welcome to the 21st. Welcome back to Illinois, at least our airwaves. So I should point out, as I mentioned, the subtitle of your book, Everything I Thought I Needed to Know About Life, I learned from watching 80s movies. You were born in Skokie, grew up on the North Shore, not far from where a lot of these movies were set. What was it about John Hughes films that so deeply resonated with you as a child of the 80s?
I think when I was a kid, it was just that I saw movies that took place in my backyard, which you know, when you watch movies, they're usually in California or they're in New York, and you didn't really see Chicago represented in films. And I think that resonated with me pretty quickly. Like, seeing that meant that, oh, my, there's something special about the place that I live in, and that meant a lot to me as a kid. And then as I got older, I started kind of taking the messages from the films and the themes to heart a little bit more.
Well, and you took them to heart so much that you wrote, like, when you turned 13, you were hoping your life would just start looking like a John Hughes film. Were you disappointed when that happened or didn't really happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think I started thinking that even earlier on. Like, I remember watching Pretty in Pink and 16 Candles and thinking, oh, this is exactly, it's like, it's scripted kind of. Life is supposed to be kind of like scripted, and it's supposed to go like this, where you have your ups and downs, but everything turns out all right in the end, and you get your Jake Ryan, or, you know, something works out. And, you know, I quickly realized that that wasn't so much the case. And then as I got a little bit older, into my teenage years, I realized more and more. I'm like, wow, my life is nothing like a John Hughes movie. And that was a little disappointing, yeah.
So I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about, in your book, you take us all the way back to your days in preschool. And then, of course, as you got older, your parents got divorced. Things were really rough for you for a time. And I wonder, at one point, I mean, I think all of us kind of tend to look at movies as an escape. Was that how they offered you comfort, or was it what you're sort of saying about how it was also just a familiar landscape as well because they were set in Chicago?
Oh, it was definitely, it was escapism totally for me. Like I would, those movies especially, they were like, I was trying to explain it to my wife once. I was like, they're sort of like, you know, the cozy blanket you have when you're a kid that you just kind of want to grip onto when you're not feeling good. Those movies, I mean, I love pop culture. I'm obsessed with books. I'm obsessed with music, and there's so much that I love, but those movies specifically really kind of felt like something for me to hold on to. And I think later on, when I decided I wanted to try to write a biography on John Hughes, that became also something that I felt like I could hold on to that was mine. And it just took on a different meaning than a lot of, you know, the books and movies that I've loved in my life.
Well, and I think a lot of them, whether it's, you know, you write about these drives you would take. You live in New York, but when you're back in Chicago, those drives through the northern suburbs, you can see the McAllister house from Home Alone. There's sort of just all these iconic houses that are around the North Shore area, right? Whether it's the Ferris Bueller house, or I wonder what is it you think about? And there is something about home that is kind of a really interesting theme in a lot of his movies. What was it for you, I think? I wonder, do you feel like, were you really attached to those physical houses as well as a kid?
Oh, I think, I mean, I realized pretty, I saw Home Alone when I was about 9 years old. That came out, I was the same age as Macaulay Culkin, and I specifically remember thinking, I have seen that house somewhere. I know exactly where that house is. And I don't know if I was right that I had actually seen it before, but I know that it was sort of on the way to go pick up a friend who I played hockey with. So there was a pretty good chance that I had passed that house. And then like things like, you know, there's a church in 16 Candles that I know I'd passed before. And seeing all those things and kind of being like, oh, these places are, you know, they look so beautiful on camera. And there's like a cinematic quality to this place that I'm from. That really helped me kind of fall deeper. I mean, I love Chicago and the suburbs, but those movies, I think, really helped me fall deeper in love with, like, everything from Hughes to Frank Lloyd Wright houses that you could find to old, you know, mansions in Lake Forest that are still there. I'm still obsessed with the lay of the land. It's a really incredible and beautiful area.
Right. And so there's the physical house, and then I think there's also sort of the emotional attachment we have too, right? And you write about your dad and your stepmom's house as maybe the only home that you ever got very attached to. Why was that?
It just looked, I mean, it kind of had a Hughes quality to it. Like, I remember, you know, we go up this hill. I actually just drove past it. I showed my little brother, my half-brother, the house a few months ago. He hadn't seen it since he was a little kid. And, you know, I remember everything about it so perfectly. And it's, you drive up this little hill, and, you know, Illinois, or northern Illinois at least, is pretty flat. So when you have a hill, it's kind of, it feels like you're going into a different world. But you go up this little hill, and there's this beautiful big brick house with an acre and a half, 2 acres of land behind it. And it was just so bucolic and, like, wonderful, and it had a fireplace and wooden floors. It just looked to me like what a house, what I imagine, like, a house should look like. And, you know, it wasn't anything grand or, you know, huge or ostentatious like you see with a lot of these, like, McMansions around the area. It was just a beautiful, warm place, and I really wanted it to be my home forever.
I'm talking to Jason Diamond. He's based in New York now, where he's a sports editor for RollingStone.com, but his new memoir is called Searching for John Hughes, or Everything I Thought I Needed to Know About Life I Learned from Watching 80s Movies. And Jason, I mean, when you think about that, as you're describing that, I also want to contrast that with the childhood that you had, because, you know, you grew up Jewish on Chicago's North Shore. You know, you quote your grandfather saying we'd never be accepted. And you say that's sort of like the closest thing your family had to a family motto. I think lots of people might remember the sort of the in your childhood, 10 years prior to that, the infamous sort of neo-Nazi group that marched through Skokie that was in 76. What was it like for you, your childhood?
It was, you know, I've spent a lot of time trying to work through it. It was pretty rough. You know, I do write about how my parents got divorced pretty early on, but my, you know, it was always pretty chaotic. You know, either, you know, there was physical and emotional abuse. There was a lot of, you know, lying to try to gain the upper hand in the divorce between my parents, a lot of deceit. And it was hard. I moved around a lot. I like to joke that I'm one of the only people I know who went to school in Cook, Lake, and McHenry County, which if you know anything about the...
Yeah, those are pretty different counties, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you go, it's all the way up to Wisconsin. But, you know, I kind of wear that as a weird badge of honor because I'm like, well, I survived that because that was pretty difficult. But, you know, my parents, I think the fighting between them sort of influenced our relationships. And eventually, you know, my father lost custody and visitation rights with me because he kind of went over the edge in terms of how he was handling a situation. I ended up with a broken nose and cracked ribs. And a few years later, then my mom decided she wanted to move away from Chicago. And this was when I was 16 years old and sort of left me to my own devices.
And I mean, I imagine that, I mean, that's really tough. And I wonder for you how much you felt like writing for you became an outlet to sort of help cope with all of that.
Oh, I mean, it was everything to me. I mean, I started just kind of like scribbling stuff. You know, I would just anything like these, like just totally nonsensical little short stories. And, you know, this is also like kind of like I like to say that, like, I started falling in love with writing around the same time I started really falling in love with reading. Like I would read a book and I'd be like, I wish I could write like that. I wish I could write like Charles Dickens or Edith Wharton. You know, that's a nice thing to think when you're a kid, and that's something to hold on to. But having sort of just something to do that felt creative and felt like it was an outlet was so important. And, like, I always try to explain, in 1996, 1995, I wasn't able to, like, talk to people over the internet yet, really. I mean, I had AOL, but it wasn't like now where everything's connected and you don't feel so alone. I felt very isolated, so having something that was mine meant everything.
Well, and you also write about a teacher you had who was really instrumental in this, Mrs. Donovan. Why did she make such a difference in your life?
I think when I was a kid, I picked up on the fact that she really cared. I think at that point in my life, I didn't really think, I just didn't trust people. I realize now I had pretty good reason not to trust, especially adults.
Sure.
And she really didn't seem to have any reason to lie to me or to want to let me down. And she was also really instrumental in, like, getting me to read. She was the person who started giving me books besides, like, the basic, you know, the course books that we're supposed to look at. You know, she was like, one of the first people, I think, who took an interest in me. And that really, I don't know, you know, it sounds kind of like a Disney movie almost. Like, oh, yeah, you know, the kind of weird kid who has the one adult who helps them out. And, but it's, you know, that's a wonderful and beautiful thing when somebody actually goes out of their way. And I would love to know how many other kids she did that with. You know, they probably weren't in my same situation, but, you know, that's an insane thing. It's like, she probably changed so many lives. I think about that all the time because she certainly changed mine.
Right. And you write about this, she actually died before you got the chance to thank her.
Yeah. That was really tough. It's something that's one of the things I still regret.
But it also sounds like it was for you a real opportunity to sort of really think about the role that people can play in other people's lives.
Yeah, and that's something that I was actually pretty impressed with at a reading I did a few months, like a month ago. Somebody, you know, when you do the Q&A at the end of the reading, it wasn't so much a question, but one of the people in the audience brought up the fact that they noticed the theme in the book was the goodness of people and the willingness to, you know, try to help people out, which is something that, you know, I've only in the last few years, as I get older, really started to appreciate how lucky I am that I've had people. I mean, I'm sure we all do, but we just don't maybe realize it. And it's made me really sensitive to that now. And I really look for and try to appreciate, you know, any little thing, you know, because it might not be like taking teenage me in and giving me somewhere to live, but I just genuinely am appreciative of anybody who, you know, tries to do good for others.
Well, and it's kind of really interesting when you say that, because I think that that's sort of, there's like sort of, and when you're thinking about John Hughes and his films, there's kind of like this, either, you know, there's always kind of like a little bit of a dark side to his films that are sort of like all the kind of the teenage tough things. But then I guess you probably would see that's also the positive. There's always those one or two really good characters or the happy ending or the way things get resolved in a lot of his films too.
Yeah, I mean, there's a decent balance, I think. Like, he doesn't do I think you could only show so much of the teenage experience. I think what he did well was he just did it better than anybody else. Like, he actually, instead of, you know, the teen movies that kind of preceded Hughes were like Meatballs and, you know, these kind of they were called gross out films, you know, with plenty of nudity and like crass jokes, and, you know, some people love those movies and that's fine, but he really, I think, tried his best to do something that both told real stories, but also connected with audiences, because he was very sensitive to that because he had come from an advertising background. He knew that you had to really emotionally connect with people for something to work, and he understood how to emotionally connect with a large audience that he might not be able to see. So there's a lot at play in his films that you might not realize, but I think it's an interesting balance, and I've always kind of found that fascinating.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Jason Diamond. His new memoir is called Searching for John Hughes, or Everything I Thought I Needed to Know About Life I Learned from Watching 80s Movies. And the really interesting thing about this, Jason, is you never actually met him, right? Or you maybe think you might have had a moment where you met him in Chicago.
I think we've breathed the same air a few times. Actually, there was a few other times besides that, but I write about a couple of those instances in the book, and yeah, came close. It never happened, and I'm kind of disappointed that it didn't.
When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Chicago native Jason Diamond. His memoir is called Searching for John Hughes. Stay tuned. You're listening to a special encore edition of The 21st. We'll be right back.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Listening to the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. The soundtrack to the songs from Pretty in Pink are for many a soundtrack to their childhood, accompanied, of course, by films by John Hughes. We've been talking with Jason Diamond. His new memoir is called Searching for John Hughes, or Everything I Thought I Needed to Know About Life I Learned from Watching 80s Movies. He's on the line with us from New York, where he now lives. Jason, at what point did you decide, I want to write a biography of John Hughes?
I actually write about it in the book, but I think I'd been mentally toying with it a little bit because a friend had kind of, in a bar of all places, which is never a good place to come up with an idea, or maybe it is, but a friend.
It depends on the idea, right? I think for a book,
yeah,
it would probably be a good one.
Yeah, I think, I'm sure some good books have been, you know, hatched up in bars, but a friend had said you should write his biography. You know so much about him. And, you know, when you're 23 years old and not really thinking much about, like, the bigger picture, that sounds like an adequate idea. Like, yeah, maybe I can do that. And I think that it was in my brain for a few days. And then a few days after that, I went out to dinner with somebody I knew in high school and got a little drunk. And I think panicked, and when they kept asking me what I was working on, I just decided to say, I'm working on a John Hughes biography, which that was the birth of the idea. And that's probably where the, you know, proclaiming that I was doing it maybe wasn't the best time or place.
But then you actually do it, and there's something, I mean, I learned about John Hughes in this, like, I didn't realize the backstory to National Lampoon's Vacation. That John Hughes, can you share that story with everybody? Because that's, I think, like, John Hughes trivia that I think even in Illinois, where, and I think people from the Chicago area, but then I think people from Illinois probably have a much broader knowledge of John Hughes than the rest of the population. But can you share that story?
Vacation 58, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it was something he had written. He was actually a joke writer. I don't know if I talk about this part in the book, but he was actually a joke writer on the side after he had dropped out of college in Arizona, and he'd written jokes for, like, Joan Rivers and I think Rodney Dangerfield. And, you know, back then, you know, you'd send them jokes and they'd send you money, I think, for it. And, you know, that was his foot in the door. You know, nobody ever said, oh, John Hughes wrote that joke. But he was kind of doing that. He was, like, moonlighting as a joke writer while he was working at this advertising agency. And then he started sending stuff to National Lampoon, and they thought he was really funny. And one of those pieces was Vacation 58, and that was the basis for National Lampoon's, the first National Lampoon Vacation movie. And, you know, I think it's the best one of them all, but, and I believe there's a second story that also was the basis for A Christmas Vacation.
Yeah.
But those are his characters, and yeah.
Well, and it's great. It's a great trivia about John Hughes. I mean, when you started doing this, I mean, what were the most surprising things you learned about John Hughes as you sort of start working on really looking into his life?
Well, I think it was a lot of, like, personal stuff because, you know, like I said, I was in my early 20s, so I think I had this more romantic view of this artist I liked. And I started kind of realizing, like, oh, I don't think, you know, I found out he was, like, the, I believe he and PJ O'Rourke were considered sort of like the Republicans of the National Lampoon staff. Like, they were sort of like he had all these, like, kind of crazy 60s holdover guys and the people who would go on to write for Saturday Night Live. And then you had John Hughes, who was this, like, Midwestern guy. And finding out he was sort of like the outsider for that staff was kind of interesting to me. And it started to make more sense when later on I started reading about him, you know, going to live in Los Angeles for a few years and then realizing he hated Los Angeles and he wanted to be back in Chicago. He's an interesting guy, and I'm still to this day trying to figure out some of his motives for some of the things he did.
Right, because I bet there are questions you really wish you could call him up and ask him. Before we get to that, because I do want to ask you that, so I mentioned this, we talked about this before the break. There was a time, you write about this in the book, that you might have actually met him when you were in high school. What would you have said if you realized that was him at the time?
When I was in high school, I've thought about that, and to this day, I still cannot tell you. I think.
So you were at a Dominick's, right?
Yeah, I'm glad you remembered it was a Dominick's, because most people just say grocery store, but it's very important to me that it was a
Dominick's. That was a Dominick's and not a Jewel, right? Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. Right. I honestly, you know, I was like 15 or 16 or 17, whatever I was a teenager. I probably would have started off with like a nervous kind of like Beavis and Butthead sort of. But I probably would have like wanted to ask him if he needed any help, like if he wanted, you know, somebody to like an assistant or something. I mean, I've always been kind of, I've always been like, I always want to be working and doing stuff, but I could have seen 16-year-old me being like, hey, do you need any help with like anything? Can I just get to know you somehow?
So adult you, the adult you that wrote the memoir, what would you ask him now?
Oh, I mean, now the first thing I would ask him where he went. I mean, that was really what I wanted to know because, you know, he had this string of 80s movies and, you know, I have these theories that I've always kind of thought were correct. I as much as I know about him, I think they're correct, but I always kind of felt like he got burnt out by critics sort of not, I think, respecting the teen movies especially. And then when, you know, Home Alone hit big, he was like, well, I could just go on autopilot and do this and make lots of money and not have people.
Right, just kind of turning these out. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and people aren't going to criticize what I truly love. And that's just what I've always wondered is just how much, why he walked away, because he did. He faded from view and he stopped. He directed a few movies. That's the thing people forget is that he only directed a handful of those movies. He didn't direct Pretty in Pink, and he didn't direct Some Kind of Wonderful.
What about Planes, Trains, and Automobiles?
Did he direct that?
Yeah.
Yes, that one he did.
He did direct Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Okay. And Uncle Buck? And I guess you would put Uncle Buck is kind of in that Home Alone, right? I guess it's in that maybe. I don't know. Would you put Uncle Buck in that? Kind of later, maybe I'm just making money version of John Hughes.
No, I think that one came out right before. I think that was a year before Home Alone. And you know what? I'm going to say no to that because I think I think John Candy is a comedic genius. But I think he really loved working with John Candy. That's sort of a thing that people like to talk about is that John Candy, he felt like they were kindred spirits and I think he really wanted to write and direct roles for John Candy. And that's why I think Uncle Buck is a pretty funny movie. I think Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, I always do that, is
kind of a classic, right? Yeah. Well, can I ask you about Ferris Bueller? Because I think that, and I wonder, I think it's maybe a little bit different inside Illinois, but outside of Illinois, but I'm thinking in particular of how much Ferris Bueller still sort of resonates with kind of bored suburban youth everywhere. And it's sort of this kind of, you know, it's kind of this fantasy that every kid has that they could be like Ferris. And I'm just thinking about a couple of years ago when there was that Twitter account, that parody account of somebody who recreated Ferris's day on Twitter. I don't know if you saw that, but
oh, I didn't know.
Yeah, it was like this great account. And they went around Chicago and they were in real time, just like the movie, recreating Ferris's day on Twitter. And it was like this big sensation in Chicago. It was a couple of years ago. But I guess I just wonder for you what you think. I mean, now that we have sort of we have now decades on that movie, if you think maybe time has been kinder to that movie than critics maybe were at the time for John Hughes?
To that specific movie?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I actually do. I think of all the films from that from the teen trilogy, I guess,
right.
Let's say,
mm-hmm.
So 16 Candles, Breakfast Club, and Ferris, I think Breakfast Club, I think, is a great film, and it stands up, and it's a classic. But I think Ferris Bueller is the movie that, when I talk to teens, which I've talked to a lot of teens about these movies before and since the book came out, which is kind of funny.
Yeah, what do they say?
They love Ferris Bueller. And they love Home Alone. That's, you know, because they saw Home Alone. That's like a child's movie, but it still is like a movie that everybody likes. But Ferris Bueller is the one that I think people still see as like, oh, that's a cool movie, because it looks cool. I mean, it's a timeless film. You know, they're in this cool Ferrari. They all dress well. There's something in that movie for everybody. You know how like the whole thing is with the Breakfast Club is you relate to one of the characters when you're in high school, supposedly. But I think you can either feel like you're a Cameron or you feel like you're a Ferris when you see Ferris Bueller.
Which one
relatable.
Were you?
I was definitely a Cameron. I think I was a mix between Cameron and Allison from The Breakfast Club.
Okay.
But I do think that movie really, it holds up. And I mean, I watch it constantly and I'm still amazed just how cool it looks and how funny it is. And the timing and just everything about it. It's like Hughes really found he found something with that I think he was trying to work towards with the prior movies.
And I mean, I know this is a tough question. Do you feel like that's something that he would have realized before he died, sort of like that had staying power? Is that kind of what you'd want to ask him if you could?
You see, I'm always curious about that, because it's only in the last few years since he died that I've really seen his culture, influence move beyond film. Because, you know, there were some movies like Mean Girls, which I thought was, you know, brilliant and hilarious, and it was a total take on, it was Tina Fey's take on a John Hughes movie up to,
right.
like, the Shermer High School, I think they went to the same high school. But I've noticed in the last few years, when you look at, like, YA books, like Rainbow Rowell or John Green, or that movie that came out last year, The Edge of 17, I'm like, these are directly influenced by him. There's no denying that. And I wonder, like, if he would have, what he would have thought of that. Because he was starting to, around the time of his death, he was starting to write more publicly. He had written for Zoetrope magazine, the magazine started by Francis Ford Coppola. He'd written some stuff. He'd shared some short stories. I think he was gearing up to sort of do something. And I don't know what it was, but unfortunately we won't find out, I guess.
Right. And we should, John Hughes died in 2009. He had a heart attack. He was 59. Jason, for you, I guess, what did you end up learning about yourself through writing this book?
It's less about learning. I learned to
realizing,
sort of like,
maybe.
Well, I did learn a lot. I learned how to be a better, I mean, writing a book is a pretty intense and, like really writing a book, like knowing that it's actually going to be published and spending all your time with it. That's a very intense and rewarding experience. But I think I've always been really hard on myself for things that were not necessarily that were kind of out of my control. And writing a memoir is a really good way to sort of face down a lot of those things and to sort of learn that you weren't as responsible as you thought for things that you might not be so proud of, and you can learn to forgive yourself more. And I like to joke, it's sort of somebody who's not shy about going to therapy. It's probably the best therapy in a year span that I ever went through. It really helped me kind of like learn a lot about myself and kind of appreciate myself a little bit more.
Jason Diamond's new memoir, Searching for John Hughes.
That's all we have time for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell her, ask NPR One to play The 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, and every other way to contact us via phone, email, or social media is at our website, 21stshow.org. Follow us on Twitter, search for 21stshow. We live tweet during the show with more analysis and background about what we're discussing. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us. You can comment about what we're working on or post questions or comments you want us to ask on air. We're produced by Christine Herman, Alan Montecelio, Sean Newman, and Robert Hawley. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Brian Moldine, in for Nyla Voodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.